Hi, and welcome to Collider Science. Here you find answers about cognition that you may or may not have asked yourself. This episode is hosted by Sönke Löw and Elisa Palme. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode.
In today's episode, in our blog on linguistics, we will talk about the acquisition of adjectives. And for that, we have invited Charlotte Uhlemann. She did her bachelor's in patholinguistics at the University of Potsdam, and then her master's in cognitive science at the University of Osnabrück. And now she is a PhD student at the SPA lab at the University of Osnabrück. And she also is a speech therapist focused on language acquisition disorders. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And as always, we play our short get-to-know game where you get 5 sentence beginnings and I will ask you to continue them as spontaneously as you can. Our first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
As a kid, I wanted to become a pharmacist, actually, because I love this calm, clean atmosphere there and the supportive and patient-oriented environment. But now that I think about it more, I realize that working with kids is actually more messy and also way louder than working at a pharmacy. But yeah, that was my initial idea of adulthood.
Our next sentence. If I was an emoji, I would be.
Right now, since spring is springing again, I would be a tulip.
Tulip, yeah. See that. I think it's always a bit sad that you can't change the color of the flowers, flower emojis. It would be so awesome to have different colored tulips, especially.
Okay, if I needed to specify, I would be a maybe an orange tulip today. I feel orange. Something pinkish.
Next sentence. My favorite thing to do on a day off is
taking my dog Manka for a walk, having coffee in the sun, and spending some time with friends and family and my partner.
That sounds like a good day, especially in spring now where days get longer and are more sunny. I think the last week was so good for just blowing up again and getting outside without getting wet.
I feel like everything is blossoming and awaking again. It's really, really nice.
Our next sentence. Right now, I'm most fascinated by...
Right now, but also in general, I'm very impressed and fascinated by the ease and speed with which children learn new words and comprehend our world with all its diverse concepts. And especially my nephew has been my inspiration for that and a genuine language talent. So I'm always very amazed by that.
And our last sentence. I know it's time to call it a day when.
When there's definitely too many tabs open in my head as well as on my laptop and I can't really filter anymore. So this is when I really know, okay, I need to get some distance and get away from the desk.
Do you just close the tabs on your laptop or do you leave them open for the next day?
Depends. So sometimes when I really don't need anything anymore, I'll just close them and wave them goodbye. But I also have some tabs that I leave open also as reminders to continue working on something. But I also always try to have like different browser windows sorted by topic. So yeah, I have a whole system developed there. But yeah, whenever I feel, okay, this is now getting too crowded, I need to reset and work all that out again.
Yeah. I think that's really relatable. Okay. Can you maybe tell us a bit about how you got being actually both a speech therapist at the moment and also a PhD student researching on language acquisition?
I think it's easiest to go a bit further back in history, or in my history at least, to explain that better. So I started out, as you already alluded to, as a patholinguist in my bachelor's. And this is also why I was working as a speech and language therapist then back in Potsdam, so my home city. But I always felt like I wanted to explore more psychology and neuroscience topics more in depth. And this is why I applied for the COXI program in Osnabrück, moved here. I still miss the water here and the lakes.
It's raining a lot.
And it's raining a lot. I mean, right now it's really nice. But we do have more sunny days in Potsdam, actually. But yeah, I was always interested in like broadening my horizon a bit more, not only, I mean, I also enjoy working with patients, but not only doing that. And this is how I came to Osnabrück, did my master's here. And then I was already working as a research assistant in the spa lab, because I discovered that Nicole got to Osnabrück and now filled this, or now in 2021-22, filled this professorship for linguistics, because I couldn't really study any linguistics during my master's because mm-hmm. she wasn't there yet. And that's how I, why I applied to work with her as a research assistant. And this is also how I got this position, because then at some point she offered me the PhD position. But I still wanted to combine my both interests. This is what I really enjoy when I can work in the academic field, looking at the more theoretical side. And at the same time, always on Fridays, I'm at the kindergarten and I have my patients there and I treat children with language disorders.
Do you, since you do both have the, or since you have both the research background and the practical background, see that you approach things differently than you might if you wouldn't have this connection?
Yeah, so I think so. Since this was already always part of my training as a patholinguist, you always look at the, let's say, a typical development of children, and then of course you also look out for, okay, what difficulties do children also experience while acquiring language. I always have these both views on things, yeah, and always when I'm reading through the literature and see experimental work, I'm also always wondering, okay, but what about children with developmental language disorders? How would they perform here, or how would they go about it? So, yeah, I think this gives me a more broad perspective. But sometimes it's also a bit tricky because I feel like I'm in between fields a bit. Mm-hmm. And yeah, sometimes this also makes me wander a bit.
Before we go deeper into children that struggle with language acquisition, we first want to take a step back and look at the broader picture. And while preparing for this episode, we found the terms semantics and pragmatics used a lot. And I think most people have an understanding of what semantics is. But before I started studying cognitive science, I had no real intuition what pragmatics is. So could you maybe shortly explain what the two terms are and what the difference between them is?
Mm-hmm. Before I do that, is it okay if I actually take another step back?
Sure.
Have an even more higher level explanation of, okay, which part of linguistics are we actually delving into right now? So in general, we distinguish different levels of linguistic analyses, so different studies of linguistic phenomena. And first of all, we have the sound level focused on phonetics and phonology, so the speech sounds we perceive and produce, and of course our articulation. Secondly, we have the word level, so lexicon and semantics. You've already alluded to it. So this is most basically the study of vocabulary and word meaning, but also our taxonomy, so how we come up with different categories for words. We also have the structure level, so morphology and syntax. This is concerned with word formation and sentence construction, or also known as grammar. And then ultimately the use level, so pragmatics is actually about the context and what we intend and imply. So summing that up again, semantics is about what is said and the word meaning, and pragmatics is a bit further down the line, so what is communicated and the contextual meaning. And from a developmental perspective in semantics, we are interested in word learning, while in pragmatics we are more interested in the question of, okay, how do children use words appropriately in social interactions? But we also, of course, see these precursors of pragmatic development, such as dyadic and triadic interactions between mother and child. So mother and child facing each other, mother and child interacting with a cup or something like that, or with a ball or something else that enters their interaction space. And from the literature, we know that pragmatic development tends to be a bit later. So this is what we observe in children, since it relies on more complex social, cognitive, and also inferential abilities. And because it builds on this foundation of basic vocabulary and grammar.
You already mentioned that, or I interpreted you now as saying that semantics comes before pragmatics in the learning process, and
yes and no. Okay. But I can elaborate a bit more on that. So actually, on this process of language acquisition, so we know that acquiring especially a first language proceeds in different stages, which is very nice because this is very clean and structured about linguistics and working with children. So they reach certain milestones in language comprehension and production. So we always have this like split. We always differentiate between comprehension and production abilities. And we also know that these milestones are pretty similar actually across languages. And when we study how children learn language, of course, we see how these linguistic patterns unfold step by step, year by year. And then what is really nice about this process is that we actually reveal and look behind the facade and see how communication is actually shaped and how it progresses over time. And I like to think of this process as that it really takes a village to raise a child. And also from the other perspective, we learn also more about the adult speakers and what fully developed language then ultimately means when we see how it actually comes to that. Even though, of course, as adults, we're also continuous learners ourselves, and we still learn new words or other languages. I mean, I'm also not a native speaker of English. German is my first language, and then second language acquisition is also a completely different story. So there's also a lot to say about that. But yeah, focusing on first language acquisition, this process is really very fascinating, I think, and can also tell us a lot even when our language acquisition process is more or less completed. And zooming into a bit more on this level of lexical and semantic development, we know that children usually utter their first words on the production side at the age of 1 year. And what I like to ask, so I also have a question for you. I'm always in search of first words. Do you remember your first words by chance?
Unfortunately not, no.
Okay, well, no, you don't.
Not remembered. I would assume just first words from just classical would have been like mama, papa, but I'm not sure for myself. Mm-hmm. I just know that when I was 1 year and a bit, there was a situation where my mom and I went to the grocery store and one man blinked at me like with one eye and smiled at me. And it was, my mom said like maybe 14, 15 months. And my answer was Mann mich schäkert, so man flirt me. So schäkern is a German dialect word or less often used word, I would say, for flirting. And because my parents said schäkern or this word so often in any context where I was kind of just really friendly smiling with other people, I just got the sentence so into my head and just said like, man flirt me in a way. And I know that my mom had a notebook where she wrote down cute and funny things I said when I was younger. But yeah. I have no idea what happened to it.
That would be really
interesting. Yeah, I just know that that's the tale.
Yeah, oh, that's nice. These are always such good resources, actually. So like a real corpus study almost. I'm always very, very proud of parents who keep track of that. Mm-hmm. Very nice. Yeah, mine was actually papa, so dad too. And why I'm always asking about this is because actually Nicole's son's first word, so my supervisor's first word, was alle, as in empty. Oh. And this actually like triggered this whole research idea for the project that I'm working in my PhD, because alle is actually an absolute adjective. We can come to that later when I explain maybe the differences between the different adjective types. But it's really interesting because there are some properties about that which makes it really interesting to look at. And this like state of something apparently was really interesting at that point in time. So, yeah. Actually, first words have a lot of power. they can bring about whole research endeavors.
I think the first word of the daughter of a friend of mine was oopsie.
Oopsie.
Yeah. That's just really cute.
My best friend's word was bugger, and he's an engineer now. So it was kind of already in line with his interests. Yeah. So yeah, actually, it's pretty interesting. And going back to linguistics again, this is also, you were already referring to like almost a sentence, like man, what was it?
Man mich schäkert, so man me flirt.
Yeah, so this is already a pretty well-rounded phrase, I would say, but before that, so in this one-word stage, these single words actually represent whole sentences, and then children progress into this two-word stage and then even more words than that. So they continuously build up the receptive and expressive vocabulary. And what we also know is that usually comprehension, so understanding words, precedes production, which also makes sense intuitively. And then around 18 months, they know approximately 50 words. So this is also referred to as the 50 word stage, so to say. So we have this one word stage, and then we have the 50 words. So one word stage productively, and then the 50 word stage on the comprehension side. And then also around that time, so, and maybe you actually were in that age frame, I would guess. In that time between 18 to 24 months, we observe this very interesting vocabulary spurt or vocabulary explosion. And this is when children actually learn like new concepts every day. So they learn a new word almost every day. And this happens via fast mapping. So mapping a word to an object. And this is also what is tricky and challenging about adjective acquisition, because adjectives are actually harder for children to acquire than nouns and verbs from a structural semantic perspective, because they don't really label this entire object, but they label one certain property of an object. And this is, of course, against this natural habit of children to link words to entire objects. And this is actually very challenging for them and often referred to as the Gavagai problem in the literature. So really, the challenge that adjectives pose to children is then to determine the exact reference. So what is meant from the context, with all the different possibilities that we have in our world, in our visual field, so what they perceive, also in comparison to all the words they already know. So figuring that out is really, really tricky, but also what makes it very interesting to study adjectives.
Maybe referring on those specific kind of traits adjectives have, do you know how exactly children use linguistic context or syntactic cues to acquire the meaning of those adjectives, especially when they're kind of can be stronger or weaker?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you already referred to, what I gather from the context from your question, is this distinction. Okay, we have different adjective types and they work kind of differently also in their acquisition. So this is also because this class of adjectives is so big and so distinct in some ways because of the underlying semantics. This is what makes also a bit of what brings a lot of variance in the acquisition process with it. So basically, we distinguish between certain types of adjectives, and this is also how we then try to come up with the classification and the process of their acquisition. So we distinguish here between non-gradable adjectives and gradable adjectives. And unlike non-gradable adjectives, our gradable adjectives, they denote properties that can vary in intensity or degree, while non-gradable adjectives, as their name already says, cannot. And
could you maybe give an example for both?
Yeah, I will give you an example in a sec. this gradability allows us to compare and order objects. So an example for a gradable adjective would be something like tall, and an example for a non-gradable adjective would be something like German or English. So you can't really be more German or more English than anyone else. Or, for example, pregnant. So you can't be more... I mean, yeah, of course, you can see through the pregnancy, but you can't really be pregnant, a bit pregnant. That doesn't really work. And also a way to test, for example, for that would be that the gradable adjectives, they combine with degree modifiers, such as a very tall tree. So you can put a modifier before the adjective and test for their gradability. And the way we know that children acquire these gradable adjectives, so we focus on this gradable dimension of adjectives, is that they usually, and this is now that we come, now we come back to the semantics pragmatics distinction. So usually they acquire the semantics first, so the basic semantic properties, and then later they also include the contextual meaning and incorporate that into the whole meaning of the adjectives. And what we focus on in our research is a even more specific distinction of gradable adjectives, namely absolute and relative adjectives, which children can are acquiring around the age of 4. So then they know the core semantic properties and also successfully, implicitly, of course, they don't really do that explicitly. Implicitly, then they also distinguish different adjective types. And this is actually my focus in my research. So, okay, we do have different adjective types having different semantic properties. And thinking of our alle example, empty being somewhere on this scale, we try to figure out, okay, which semantic properties make it easy or hard for children to be acquired, and therefore which types of adjectives are maybe a bit easier or more difficult to learn. And in our work, we distinguish three different or main types of adjectives. So we look at minimum standard adjectives, maximum standard adjectives, and relative adjectives. Minimum standard adjectives work on a lower closed scale. So as their name also already implies, in linguistics, it's usually very obvious. some idea that we have also always goes hand in hand with the name, how we label it, so to make it a bit easier. So minimum standard adjectives need a minimal amount of something to apply. So as an example, we would have dirty, for example. So a shirt to count as dirty needs a minimum amount of dirt on it. Otherwise, it would be clean. But if there's at least some dirt on it, then it's already dirty. And along the scale, then it can be even more dirt, but it is still dirty. For maximum standard adjectives, this works a bit differently. So they have a closed scale with clear limits. In the minimum standard case, this is at the like zero point of the scale. And with maximum standard adjectives, it's either at the end of the scale or even on both ends. So really limiting this scale. And here we would have an example such as full. So a container or a cup cannot be fuller than full. It's the maximum amount of water or tea that goes into this cup that makes it full. And last but not least, we also have relative adjectives, which take their meaning from context. And they sit on an open scale with no real fixed start or end point. So their standard of comparison also shifts with the situation. And an example for a relative adjective would be tall. So someone who's tall for a child would also, in comparison, maybe look short next to a tall basketball player. So this is what I mean with this context dependency. Relative adjectives always need to be compared to something, while minimum and maximum, so our absolute adjectives, they don't need that much context. They are more context independent.
My intuition would be that the relative adjectives might be the hardest to learn because the parents may be using that from their perspective, and then the children have to learn that they themselves always need to be, or not always need to be, but usually are like the reference point when they start speaking. Is that something that is accurate, or do you know anything about this?
Mm-hmm. So this is actually what we are interested in and what we are looking at experimentally. So we actually look at this difference between absolute and relative adjectives, and we hypothesize as well that absolute adjectives, because of their semantic properties and these context-independent meanings, that they are easier to acquire than the relative adjectives. Even though we have a number of relative adjectives which are really, really frequent, so something like big, tall, hot, they do depend on the context, but they are also very frequent and salient in the input. And we try to tease apart these different adjective types and also the role of contrast, so of the context that is involved in this adjective interpretation. So we also hypothesize that contrast as instantiated, for example, by a contrast object. So think of a scale of maybe hot water, warm water, and cold water. So in order to infer water is warm, the cold object, maybe an ice cube, would help me actually to infer the meaning of the warm water. While, for example, tired, which is a minimum standard adjective, doesn't really need that much comparison. I don't need to see someone who's awake to understand someone who looks tired right next to them is tired. So, yeah, we currently try to look at that experimentally and try to prove, hopefully, that contrast is more helpful in the case of relative adjectives. And also, just one last remark. So also from corpus studies and experimental studies, we also see and understand that children learn adjectives faster in these contrasts of context. So this is actually what helps in adjective acquisition. So in order to grasp the concept of a, for example, large house, it's easiest to see a small house next to it. So you can really understand that in contrast. But also what helps adjective learning is pairing them across categories. So having this large house, for example, next to a large tree, which makes it also a bit more obvious what is meant by this term. And what we also know is that these positive adjectives, such as large, are acquired earlier than the negative. So from the polarity dimension adjectives, so the small house, for example, would be acquired later than the large. So it's always the property that displays the property, the label that explains the property, like more, is easier to grasp for children than the antonym.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it also makes sense. So this is also what I like about language acquisition. So it feels intuitive that it goes in that way.
Yeah. Are there typical errors that occur in this whole process of learning the meaning of these adjectives or types of adjectives?
Yeah, so there are, as with every word category, we have over and under generalizations. This would be a typical error, I would think. That, I mean, in the case of adjectives, I can't really think of an example right now, but for example, one really cute example that I just remembered is my nephew. As I said, he's always inspiring me and amazing me. So there was a time during his language acquisition process when he referred to all types of birds as a bufink, so a common chaffinch, and really over generalizing the word that he just learned. So this is actually a pretty common error or phenomenon that we observe during language acquisition.
Does it also happen for adjectives, or is it more on the noun side?
I try to think of, of course, now that I think more about it, properties like thick or thin are also sometimes referred to as big or small then. So something that expresses a similar dimension is then applied to other properties. And there again, we also have this antonymy again, right? So there's something with a lot of something, and then maybe something that represents this property less. So it makes sense to compare it to already known adjective combinations. Yeah. And I mean, this already goes into the direction, okay, language errors, difficulties acquiring language. So what we see in children with language disorders, or I think here it's also important to have some kind of terminology. So the children that I am mainly working with have developmental language disorders, also referred to as DLD, previously referred to as SLI, specific language impairment, but we are now moving more into the DLD labeling. And a developmental language disorder is a persistent difficulty in language comprehension and or production, despite normal nonverbal intelligence, hearing, and no other conditions such as hearing loss or autism. And these children display difficulties either on one linguistic level, so phonetics, phonology, semantics, lexicon, morphology, or syntax, or also on multiple of these linguistic levels. And what we know from the literature is that children with DLD struggle to learn semantic concepts for objects due to limited conceptual development. So it's a lot harder for them to infer the meaning of these conceptual concepts. And therefore, it's also a bit harder for them to acquire adjectives for unfamiliar concepts. And they also face difficulties with working memory. So concerning their executive functions, we also see difficulties, which is also then linked to smaller vocabularies. And on a intervention level, this means they need far more repetitions in the input. And then ultimately, this reduced vocabulary and their weaker syntactic knowledge also impair their use of bootstrapping strategies compared to typically developing children. So it's way harder for them to infer from the context, from the semantics and the syntax. And then, of course, this hinders them inferring adjective meanings from the sentence structure, especially where the context might not be so obvious. So where a sentence is, for example, ambiguous and the syntax doesn't really help, so they really don't know what's going on in the sentence. And so, yeah, they show struggles, especially at this intersection of vocabulary and morphology and syntax, which adjectives also belong to.
I am assuming that it is easier to help the children if you recognize that they might have a disorder early. But yeah. How hard is it to figure that out? Because, like, I think, like, because children all learn I guess, their words at their own pace, and then sometimes it's you don't know if it's really like the child has a disorder or maybe not. So is that something that usually gets recognized rather late, or is that really obvious? And who are like the people who recognize? Are the parents or maybe people in kindergarten who have seen like a lot of children and can compare between them?
Yeah. So we distinguish here between language delay and a language disorder. So a delay is everything ranging within a time frame between half a year to a year, diverging from like the typically developing children and their milestones. So for example, if a child didn't reach the 50 word stage at 2 years of age, then they would be considered as late talkers. A half year up until almost a year, that also depends on who you're asking and which kind of paradigm you're looking at. So these would be considered as late talkers, so a delayed language development, while everything after that would be labeled as a disorder. And then would be more problematic. But as you've already referred to, so of course, parents, they interact with their children every day. They usually notice and start wondering about their children's abilities at some points. And I think usually parents also have this tendency of, okay, is this normal? Is my child doing okay? Are we on track in the acquisition process? But also, other caretakers also have an eye on that. So pretty regularly, for example, kindergarten staff approaches me and they're asking, you know, I noticed this. Is this still normal? And then I either tell them, well, yeah, that is part of individual differences. Or, well, maybe you should go to your doctor and check with them. Or maybe, yeah, this is something that we can work on in therapy. And of course, at the pediatrician, they also have these screenings or checkups for children. And whenever they observe children having difficulties or diverging from the norms that they have, then we would also catch that. And yeah, would try to learn more about the difficulties the child has in their language learning abilities.
So how exactly are those developmental delays or disorders tested at a doctor's, or in general when you're not a doctor but talk to a person and they test for it?
Yeah, so there are of course standardized screenings for that. These regular checkups, so in German they're called U-Untersuchungen. And what we do as patholinguists is that we have a whole range of diagnostics and tests that we use. And depending on the age of the child, we also distinguish between different approaches. So for example, trying to figure out whether a child is a late talker or not is usually examined using the help of the parents. So one tool would be a parent questionnaire, where parents usually just tick boxes of suggested words, and they usually indicate whether a child can already understand and or produce a certain word. So they have really these lists. For example, the Frakis, which I examined in my bachelor's thesis. So there, they also, it's really neatly organized. So they have different semantic fields and also different So different word categories, but also different word classes. And then they ask for, can your child understand and produce the word bread or apple, and open and close, and so on and so forth. Then we also have, of course, diagnostics. So in the form of different comprehension and production tests that we do in the practice. So usually we just look at different pictures, and then I ask the children to name those pictures or to point to different pictures. So also depending on the modality that I'm examining, so comprehension or production. And what is really interesting, and this is a finding of my bachelor's thesis, so what I was able to show is that there is a very strong correlation between so this special test that I used there, so a very early language test. So there's this correlation of parental responses, so the parent questionnaire and this lab-based or practice-based test. So I was still working at the baby lab in Potsdam then. So I tested two-year-olds in the lab and compared that to the responses of parents evaluating their two-year-olds. And this is highly correlated. So even though we would assume that parents might be biased towards their children and their abilities language-wise, and they might over or underestimate them, they actually are doing a pretty good job in estimating their abilities. And it's, yeah, actually in line with what we do find when we apply those standardized tests. So this is really cool. I think this is, in general, a really nice advantage of studying linguistics and language acquisition, but also linguistics in general, because it's a phenomenon that surrounds us every day. I mean, already us just talking to each other here, there's so much going on and so much to observe. So we really are engaging with language every day. Yeah, I think that's really nice and fascinating. And we always stumble upon nice phenomena, such as children uttering their first words or interesting syntax. Funny constructions in our in our language.
I think that's a good statement to wrap this episode up. And as you already said, like, language always surrounds us, and that neatly ties into the standard question we always ask at the end. So what is cognition to you, and how does it or what role does it play in the work you do?
Mm-hmm. So in general, cognition enables language, but also language acquisition by supporting, of course, memory or working memory, attention, pattern recognition, and of course, concept formation. And looking at this language acquisition perspective a bit more, language also, of course, develops through general thinking, so it's linked to cognition and learning abilities.
And when someone has listened to this episode, what should they definitely take home or remember?
Mm-hmm. Language surrounds us every day. And language acquisition offers a unique window into how our minds develop, how we process linguistic information, and also how we construct meaning through our interaction with the world.
With that said, thank you so much for talking to us today. And it was really interesting and a pleasure.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed as well.
Thanks for giving me this opportunity.
Sure.
This was Kaleidoscience. We hope that you enjoyed this episode and we would love to have your feedback. You can rate our podcast and give us feedback on our Instagram account. Have a great week, and you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. This episode was hosted by Søren Gelöf and Elisa Palmer. Produced by Imogen Hüsing, Clara Kühne, Sophie Kühne, Søren Gelöf and Elisa Palmer. The music is from Jan-Luca Schröder and the logo is from Annika Richter.